forearm. The thin lobster metal that protected the joint crunched. The knight groaned, turning, wrenching his weapon up. This time, Bronn stood his ground. The swords flew at each other, and their steel song filled the garden and rang off the white towers of the Eyrie.
"Sir Bardas is hurt,"
Sir Roderick said, his voice grave. Catelyn did not need to be told. She had eyes. She could see the bright finger of blood running along the knight's forearm, the wetness inside the elbow joint. Every parry was a little slower and a little lower than the one before. Sir Bardas turned his side to his foe, trying to use his shield to block instead, but Bronn slid around him, quick as a cat. The sellsword seemed to be getting stronger. His cuts were leaving their marks now. Deep, shiny gashes gleamed all over the knight's armor. On his right thigh, his beaked visor, crossing on his breastplate, a long one along the front of his gorget. The moon and falcon rondel of Sir Vardis's right arm was sheared clean in half, hanging by its strap. They could hear his labored breath rattling through the air holes in his visor. Blind with arrogance as they were, even the knights and lords of the Vale could see what was happening below them. Yet her sister could not. "Enough, Sir Vardis," Lady Eliza called down. "Finish him now. My baby is growing tired." And it must be said of Sir Vardis Egan, he was true to his lady's command, even to the last. One moment he was reeling backward, half-crouched behind his scarred shield. The next he charged. The sudden bullrush caught Bronn off balance. Sir Vardis crashed into him and slammed the lip of his shield into the sellsword's face. Almost, almost, Bronn lost his feet. He staggered back, tripped over a rock, and caught hold of the weeping woman to keep his balance. Throwing aside his shield, Sir Vardis lurched after him, using both hands to raise his sword. His right arm was blood from elbow to fingers now. Yet his last desperate blow would have opened Bronn from neck to navel, if the sellsword had stood to receive it. But Bronn jerked back. John Aaron's beautiful engraved silver sword glanced off the marble elbow of the weeping woman and snapped, keen a third of the way up the blade. Bronn put his shoulder into the statue's back. The weathered likeness of Alyssa Aaron tottered and fell with a great crash, and Sir Vardis Egan went down beneath her. Bronn was on him in a heartbeat, kicking what was left of his shattered rondel aside to expose the weak spot between arm and breastplate. Sir Vardis was lying on his side, pinned beneath the broken torso of the weeping woman. Catelyn heard the knight groan as the sellsword lifted his blade with both hands and drove it down and in with all his weight behind it, under the arm and through the ribs. Sir Vardis Egan shuddered and lay still. Silence fell over the Eyrie. Bronn yanked off his half-helm and let it fall to the grass. His lip was smashed and bloody where the shield had caught him, and his coal-black hair was soaked with sweat. He spit out a broken tooth.
"Is it over, Mother?"
the Lord of the Eyrie asked. "No," Catelyn wanted to tell him. "It's only now beginning." "Yes," Lysa said glumly, her voice as cold and dead as the captain of her guard.
"Can I make the little man fly now?"
Across the garden, Tyrion Lannister got to his feet.
"Not this little man," he said. "This little man is going down in the turnipoist. Thank you very much."
"You presume," Lysa began.
"I presume that House Aaron remembers its own words," the imp said. "As high as honour." "You promised I could make him fly,"
the Lord of the Eyrie screamed at his mother. He began to shake. Lady Lysa's face was flushed with fury. "The gods have seen fit to proclaim him innocent, child. We have no choice but to free him." She lifted her voice. "Guards, take my Lord of Lannister and his creature here out of my sight. Escort them to the bloody gate and set them free. See that they have horses and supplies sufficient to reach the Trident. and make certain all their goods and weapons are returned to them. They shall have need of them. On the high road?
The high road, Tyrion Lannister said.
Lysa allowed herself a faint, satisfied smile. It was another sort of death sentence, Catelyn realized. Tyrion Lannister must know that as well, yet the dwarf favored Lady Arryn with a mocking bow.
As you command, my lady, he said. I believe we know the way.
John.
You are as hopeless as any boys I've ever trained, Sir Alistair Thorne announced when they had all assembled in the yard. Your hands were made for manure shovels, not for swords, and if it was up to me, the lot of you would be sent to herding swine. But last night, I was told that Gurin is marching 5 new boys up the King's Road. 1 or 2 may even be worth the price of piss. To make room for them, I have decided to pass 8 of you onto the Lord Commander to do with as he will.
He called out the names one by one.
Toad, Stonehead, Oryx, Lover, Pimple, Monkey, Saloon.
Last of all, he looked at John.
And a bastard.
Pip let fly a whoop and thrust his sword in the air. Sir Alistair fixed him with a reptile stare.
They will call you men of the Night's Watch now, but you are bigger fools than the mummer's monkey here, if you believe that. You are boys still, green and stinking of summer. And when the winter comes, you will die like flies.
And with that, Sir Alistair Thorne took his leave of them. The other boys gathered round the 8 who had been named, laughing and cursing and offering congratulations. Haldor smacked Toad on the butt with the flat of his sword and shouted, Toad of the Night's Watch! Yelling that a black brother needed a horse, Pip leapt onto Gren's shoulders, and they tumbled to the ground rolling and punching and hooting. Darien dashed inside the armory and returned with a skin of sour red. As they passed the wine from hand to hand, grinning like fools, John noticed Samuel Tarly standing by himself beneath a bare, dead tree in the corner of the yard. John offered him the skin. A swallow of wine? Sam shook his head.
No, thank you, John.
Are you well?
Very well, truly, the fat boy lied. I'm so happy for you all.
His round face quivered as he forced a smile.
You will be First Ranger some day, just as your uncle was.
Is, John corrected. He would not accept that Benjen Stark was dead. Before he could say more, Haldor cried, Here, you planning to drink that all yourself? Pip snatched the skin from his hand and danced away laughing. While Gren seized his arm, Pip gave the skin a squeeze, and a thin stream of red squirted John in the face. Haldor howled in protest at the waste of good wine. John sputtered and struggled. Matha and Jerin climbed the wall and began pelting them all with snowballs. By the time he wrenched free, with snow in his hair and wine stains on his surcoat, Samwell Tarly had gone. That night, Three Finger Hub cooked the boys a special meal to mark the occasion. When John arrived at the common hall, the Lord Steward himself led him to the bench near the fire. The older men clapped him on the arm in passing. The 8 soon-to-be brothers feasted on rack of lamb baked in a crust of garlic and herbs, garnished with sprigs of mint, and surrounded by mashed yellow turnips swimming in butter. From the Lord Commander's own table, Bowen Marsh told them. There were salads of spinach and chickpeas and turnip greens, and afterwards bowls of iced blueberries and sweet cream.
Do you think they'll keep us together?
Pip wondered, as they gorged themselves happily. Toad made a face. I hope not. I'm sick of looking at those ears of yours.
Ho, said Pip, listen to the crow called a raven black. You're certain to be a ranger toad. They'll want you as far from the castle as they can. If Mad's raider attacks, lift your visor and show your face and he'll run off screaming.
Everyone laughed but Gren. I hope I'm a ranger.
You and everyone else, said Mather.
Every man who wore the black walked the wall, and every man was expected to take up steel in its defence. But the rangers were the true fighting heart of the Night's Watch. It was they who dared to ride beyond the wall, sweeping through the haunted forest and the icy mountain heights west of the Shadow Tower, fighting wildlings and giants and monstrous snow bears.
Not everyone, said Halder. It's the builders for me. What use would rangers be if the wall fell down?
The Order of Builders provided the masons and carpenters to repair keeps and towers, the miners to dig tunnels and crush stone for roads and footpaths, the woodsmen to clear away new growth, wherever the forest pressed too close to the wall. Once, it was said, they had quarried immense blocks of ice from frozen lakes deep in the haunted forest, dragged them south on sledges so the wall might be raised even higher. Those days were centuries gone, however. Now it was all they could do to ride the wall from East Watch to the Shadow Tower, watching for cracks or signs of melt, or making what repairs they could.
The old bear's no fool, Darien observed. You're certain to be a builder, and John's certain to be a ranger. He's the best sworn and the best rider among us, and his uncle was the first before he...
His voice trailed off awkwardly as he realized what he had almost said. Benjen Stark is still first ranger, Jon Snow told him, toying with his bowl of blueberries. The rest might have given up all hope of his uncle's safe return, but not him. He pushed away the berries, scarcely touched, and rose from the bench.
Aren't you going to eat those? Toad asked.
They're yours. John had hardly tasted Hub's great feast. I could not eat another bite. He took his cloak from his hook near the door and shouldered his way out. Pip followed him.
John, what is it?
Sam, he admitted. He was not at table tonight.
It's not like him to miss a meal, Pip said thoughtfully. Do you suppose he's taken ill?
He's frightened. We're leaving him. He remembered the day he had left Winterfell, all the bittersweet farewells, Bran lying broken, Rob with snow in his hair, Arya raining kisses on him after he'd given her needle. Once we say our words, we all have duties to attend to. Some of us may be sent away to Eastwatch or the Shadow Tower. Sam will remain in training, with the likes of Rast and Cougar, and all these new boys who are coming up the King's Road. God only knows what they will be like, but you can bet Sir Alistair will send them against him first chance he gets. Pip made a grimace.
You did all you could.
All we could. Wasn't enough, John said. A deep restlessness was on him as he went back to Harden's Tower for Ghost. The dire wolf walked beside him to the stables. Some of the more skittish horses kicked at their stalls and laid back their ears as they entered. John saddled his mare, mounted, and rode out from Castle Black, south across the moonlit night. Ghost raced ahead of him, flying over the ground, gone in the blink of an eye. John let him go. A wolf needed to hunt. He had no destination in mind, he only wanted to ride. He followed the creek for a time, listening to the icy trickle of water over the rocks, then cut across the fields to the King's Road. It stretched out before him, narrow and stony, and pocked with weeds. A road of no particular promise, yet the sight of it filled Jon Snow with a vast longing. Winterfell was down that road, and beyond it, River Run and King's Landing, and the Eyrie and so many other places. Casterly Rock, the Isles of Faces, the Red Mountains of Dawn, the Hundred Islands of Bravos in the sea. The smoking ruins of old Valyria, all the places John would never see. The world was down that road, and he was here. Once he swore his vow, the wall would be his home until he was as old as Maester Aemon. "I'm not sworn yet," he muttered. He was no outlaw, bound to take the black, or pay the penalty for his crimes. He had come here freely, and he might leave freely, until he said the words. He need only ride on, and he could leave it all behind. By the time the moon was full again, he would be back in Winterfell with his brothers. "Your half-brothers," a voice inside him reminded him, "and Lady Stark, who will not welcome you." There was no place for him in Winterfell, no place in King's Landing either. Even his own mother had not had a place for him. The thought of her made him sad. He wondered who she had been, what she looked like, why his father had left her. Because she was a whore or an adulterous fool, something dark and dishonorable. Or else, why was Lord Eddard too ashamed to speak of her? Jon Snow turned away from the King's Road to look behind him. The fires of Castle Black were hidden behind a hill, but the wall was there, pale beneath the moon, vast and cold, running from horizon to horizon. He wheeled his horse around and started for home. Ghost returned as he crested a rise and saw the distant glow of lamplight from the Lord Commander's tower. The direwolf's muzzle was red with blood as he trotted beside the horse. John found himself thinking of Samwell Tarly again on the ride back. By the time he reached the stables, he knew what he must do. Maester Aemon's apartments were in a stout wooden keep below the rookery. Aged and frail, the maester shared his chambers with two of the younger Stuarts, who tended to his needs and helped him in his duties. The brothers joked that he had been given the two ugliest men in the night's watch. Being blind, he was spared having to look at them. Clydus was short, bald, and chinless, with small pink eyes like a mole. Chet had a wen on his neck, the size of a pigeon's egg, and a face red with boils and pimples. Perhaps that was why he always seemed so angry. It was Chet who answered John's knock. "I need to speak to Maester Aemon," John told him. "The maester is abed, as you should be. Come back on the morrow, and maybe he'll see you." He began to shut the door. John jammed it open with his boot. "I need to speak to him now. The morning will be too late." Chet scowled. "The maester is not accustomed to being woken in the night. Do you know how old he is?"
"Old enough to treat visitors with more courtesy than you," John said. "Give him my pardons. I would not disturb his rest if it were not important.
And if I refuse?"
John had his boot wedged solidly in the door.
"I can stand here all night if I must."
The black brother made a disgusted noise and opened the door to admit him.
"Wait in the library. There's wood stutter fire. I won't have the maester catching a chill on account of you."
John had the logs crackling merrily by the time Chet led in Maester Aemon. The old man was clad in his bedrobe, but round his throat was the chain collar of his order. A maester did not remove it even to sleep.
"The chair beside the fire would be pleasant," he said, when he felt the warmth on his face.
When he was seated comfortably, Chet covered his legs with a fur and went to stand by the door. "I'm sorry to have woken you, maester," Jon Snow said.
"You did not wake me,"
Maester Aemon replied.
"I find I need less sleep as I grow older. And I am grown very old. I often spend half the night with ghosts, remembering times 50 years past, as if it were yesterday. The mystery of a midnight visitor is a welcome diversion. So tell me, Jon Snow, why have you come calling at this strange hour?"
to ask that Samuel Tarly be taken from training and accepted as a brother of the Night's Watch.
"This is no concern of Maester Aemon's," Chet complained.
"Our Lord Commander has given the training of recruits into the hands of Sir Alistair Thorne,"
the maester said gently.
"Only he may say when a boy is ready to swear his vows, as you surely know. Why then come to me?"
"The Lord Commander listens to you," John told him, "and the wounded and the sick of the Night's Watch are in your charge."
"And is your friend Samuel wounded or sick?"
"He will be," John promised, "unless you help." He told them all of it, even the part where he had set ghosts at Rest's throat. Maester Aemon listened silently, blind eyes fixed on the fire, but Chet's face darkened with each word. "Without us to keep him safe, Sam will have no chance," John finished. "He's hopeless with a sword. My sister Arya could tear him apart, and she's not yet 10. If Sir Alistair makes him fight, it's only a matter of time before he's hurt or killed." Chet could stand no more.
"I've seen this fat boy in the common hall," he said. "He is a pig, and a hopeless craven as well, if what you see is true."
"Maybe it is so," Maester Aemon said. "Tell me, Chet, what would you have us do with such a boy?"
"Leave him where he is," Chet said. "The wall is no place for the weak. Let him train until he's ready, no matter how many years that takes. Sir Alistair shall make a man of him or kill him as the gods will."
"That's stupid," John said. He took a deep breath to gather his thoughts. "I remember once I asked Maester Lewin why he wore a chain around his throat." Maester Aemon touched his own collar lightly, his bony, wrinkled fingers stroking the heavy metal links.
"Go on."
"He told me that a maester's collar is made of chain to remind him that he has sworn to serve," John said, remembering. "I asked why each link was a different metal. A silver chain would look much finer with his grey robes," I said. Maester Lewin laughed. "A maester forges his chain with study," he told me. "The different metals are each a different kind of learning. Gold for the study of money and accounts, silver for healing, iron for warcraft." And he said there were other meanings as well. The collar is supposed to remind a maester of the realm he serves. Isn't that so? Lords are gold and knights steel, but two links can't make a chain. You also need silver and iron and lead, tin and copper and bronze and all the rest. And those are farmers and smiths and merchants and the like. A chain needs all sorts of metals, and a land needs all sorts of people. Maester Aemon smiled.
"And so?"
"The Night's Watch needs all sorts, too. Why else have rangers and stewards and builders? Lord Randall couldn't make Sam a warrior, and Sir Alistair won't either. You can't hammer tin into iron, no matter how hard you beat it. But that doesn't mean tin is useless. Why shouldn't Sam be a steward?" Chet gave an angry scowl.
"I'm a steward. You think it's easy work? Fit for cowards? The Order of Stewards keeps the watch alive. We hunt and farm, tend the horses, milk the cows, gather firewood, cook the meals. Who do you think makes your clothing? Who brings up supplies from the south? The Stuarts."
Maester Aemon was gentler.
"Is your friend a hunter?"
"He hates hunting," John had to admit.
"Can he plough a field?" the maester asked. "Can he drive a wagon or sail a ship? Could he butcher a cow?"
"No." Chet gave a nasty laugh. "I've seen what happens to soft lordlings when they're put to work. Set them to churning butter, and their hands blister and bleed. Give them an axe to split logs, and they cut off their own foot."
"I know one thing Sam could do better than anyone."
"Yes?"
Maester Aemon prompted. John glanced warily at Chet, standing beside the door, his boils red and angry. "He could help you," he said quickly. "He can do sums, and he knows how to read and write. I know Chet can't read, and Clydus has weak eyes. Sam read every book in his father's library. He'd be good with the ravens, too. Animals seem to like him. Ghost took to him straight off. There's a lot he could do besides fighting. The Night's Watch needs every man. Why kill one to no end? Make use of him instead." Maester Aemon closed his eyes, and for a brief moment John was afraid that he'd gone to sleep. Finally he said,
"Maester Lewin taught you well, John Snow. Your mind is as deft as your blade, it would seem."
"Does that mean—"
"It means I shall think on what you have said,"
the maester told him firmly.
"And now I believe I am ready to sleep. Chet, show our young brother to the door."
Tyrion. They had taken shelter beneath a copse of aspens just off the high road. Tyrion was gathering dead wood while their horses took water from a mountain stream. He stooped to pick up a splintered branch and examined it critically.
"Will this do? I'm not practiced at starting fires. Morric did that for me."
"A fire?" Bronn said, spitting. "Are you so hungry to die, dwarf? Have you taken leave of your senses? A fire will bring the clansmen down on us for miles around. I mean to survive this journey, Lannister."
"And how do you hope to do that?" Tyrion asked. He tucked the branch under his arm and poked around through the sparse undergrowth looking for more. His back ached from the effort of bending. They had been riding since daybreak, when a stone-faced Selin Corbray had ushered them through the bloody gate and commanded them never to return.
"We have no chance of fighting our way back," Bronn said. "But two can cover more ground than ten and attract less notice. The fewer days we spend in these mountains, the more likely we are to reach the Riverlands. Ride hard and fast, I say. Travel by night and hole up by day. Avoid the road where we can. Make no noise and light no fires."
Tyrion Lannister sighed.
"A splendid plan, Bronn. Try it, as you like. And forgive me if I do not linger to bury you."
"You think to outlive me, dwarf?"
The sellsword grinned. He had a dark gap in his smile where the edge of Savada's Egan's shield had cracked a tooth in half. Tyrion shrugged.
"Riding hard and fast by night is a sure way to tumble down a mountain and crack your skull. I prefer to make my crossing slow and easy. I know you love the taste of horse, Bronn, but if our mounts die under us this time, we'll be trying to saddle shadow cats. And if truth be told, I think the clans will find us no matter what we do. Their eyes are all around us."
He swept a gloved hand over the high, wind-carved crags that surrounded them. Bronn grimaced.
"Then we're dead men, Lannister."
"If so, I prefer to die comfortable," Tyrion replied. "We need a fire. The nights are cold up here, and hot food will warm our bellies and lift our spirits. Do you suppose there's any game to be had? Lady Lysa has kindly provided us with a veritable feast of salt beef, hard cheese, and stale bread. But I would hate to break a tooth so far from the nearest maester."
"I can find meat."
Beneath a fall of black hair, Bronn's dark eyes regarded Tyrion suspiciously.
"I shouldn't leave you here with your fool's fire. If I took your horse, I'd have twice the chance to make it through. What would you do then, dwarf?"
"Die, most like."
Tyrion stooped to get another stick.
"You don't think I'd do it?"
"Or you'd do it in an instant if it meant your life. You were quick enough to silence your friend Shiggin when he caught that arrow in his belly."
Bronn had yanked back the man's head by the hair and driven the point of his dirk in under the ear, and afterward told Catelyn Stark that the other sellsword had died of his wound.
"He was as good as dead," Bronn said, "and his moaning was bringing them down on us. Chicken would have done the same for me, and he was no friend, only a man I rode with. Make no mistake, dwarf, I fought for you, but I do not love you."
"It was your blade I needed," Tyrion said, "not your love."
He dumped his armful of wood on the ground. Bronn grinned.
"You're bold as any sellsword, I'll give you that. How did you know I'd take your part?"
"No."
Tyrion squatted awkwardly on his stunted legs to build the fire.
"I tossed the dice. Back at the inn, you and Chicken helped take me captive. Why? The others saw it as their duty, for the honor of the lords they serve, but not you two. You had no lord, no duty, and a precious little honor. So why trouble to involve yourselves?"
He took out his knife and whittled some thin strips of bark off one of the sticks he'd gathered to serve as kindling.
"Well, why do sellswords do anything?" "For gold. You were thinking Lady Catelyn would reward you for your help. Perhaps even take you into her service. Here, that should do, I hope. Do you have a flint?"
Bronn slid two fingers into the pouch at his belt and tossed down a flint. Tyrion caught it in the air.
"My thanks," he said. "The thing is, you did not know the Starks. Lord Eddard is a proud, honourable, and honest man, and his lady wife is worse. Oh, no doubt she would have found a coin or two for you when this was all over, and pressed it in your hand with a polite word and a look of distaste. But that's the most you could hope for. The Starks look for courage and loyalty and honour in the men they choose to serve them. And if truth be told, you and Chicken were low-born scum."
Tyrion struck the flint against his dagger, trying for a spark. Nothing. Bronn snorted.
"You have a bold tongue, little man. One day someone is like to cut it out and make you eat it."
"Everyone tells me that."
Tyrion glanced up at the sellsword.
"Did I offend you? Oh, my pardons. But you are scum, Bronn. Make no mistake. Duty, honour, friendship, what's that to you?"
"No, don't trouble yourself. We both know the answer.
Still, you're not stupid. Once we reached the Vale, Lady Stark had no more need of you. But I did. And the one thing the Lannisters have never lacked for is gold. When the moment came to toss the dice, I was counting on your being smart enough to know where your best interests lay. Happily for me, you did."
He slammed stone and steel together again, fruitlessly.
"Here," said Bronn, squatting. "I'll do it."
He took the knife and flint from Tyrion's hand and struck sparks on his first try. A curl of bark began to smoulder.
"Well done," Tyrion said. "Scum you may be, but you're undeniably useful, and with a sword in your hand you're almost as good as my brother Jamie. What do you want, Bronn? Gold, land, women? Keep me alive, and you'll have it."
Bronn blew gently on the fire, and the flames leaped up higher.
"And if you die?"
"Why then, I'll have one mourner whose grief is sincere,"
Tyrion said, grinning. "The gold ends when I do." The fire was blazing up nicely. Bronn stood, tucked the flint back into his pouch, and tossed Tyrion his dagger.
"Fair enough," he said. "My sword's yours, then. But don't go looking for me to bend the knee and milord you every time you take a shit. I'm no man's toady."
"Nor any man's friend," Tyrion said. "I've no doubt you'd betray me as quick as you did Lady Stark, if you saw a profit in it. If the day ever comes when you're tempted to sell me out, remember this, Bronn. I'll match their price, whatever it is. I like living. And now, do you think you could do something about finding us some supper?"
"Take care of the horses," Bronn said,
unsheathing the long dirk he wore at his hip. He strode into the trees. An hour later, the horses had been rubbed down and fed, the fire was crackling away merrily, and a haunch of a young goat was turning above the flames, spitting and hissing.
"All we lack now is some good wine to wash down our kid," Tyrion said.
"That, a woman, and another dozen swords,"
Bronn said. He sat cross-legged beside the fire, honing the edge of his long sword with an oil stone. There was something strangely reassuring about the rasping sound it made when he drew it down the steel.
"It will be full dark soon," the sellsword pointed out. "I'll take first watch. For the good it'll do us. It might be kinder to let them kill us in our sleep."
"Oh, I imagine they'll be here long before it comes to sleep."
The smell of the roasting meat made Tyrion's mouth water. Bronn watched him across the fire.
"You have a plan?" he said flatly, with a scrape of steel on stone.
"A hope, I call it," Tyrion said. "Another toss of the dice."
"With our lives as a stake?"
Tyrion shrugged.
"Well, what choice do we have?"
He leaned over the fire and sawed a thin slice of meat from the kid.
"Ah," he sighed happily as he chewed. Grease ran down his chin. "A bit tougher than I'd like, and in want of spicing, but I'll not complain too loudly. If I were back at the Eyrie, I'd be dancing on a precipice in hopes of a boiled bean."
"And yet you gave the turnkey a purse of gold," Bronn said.
"A Lannister always pays his debts."
Even Maud had scarcely believed it when Tyrion tossed him the leather purse. The jailer's eyes had gone big as boiled eggs as he yanked open the drawstring and beheld the glint of gold.
"I kept the silver," Tyrion had told him, with a crooked smile. "But you were promised the gold, and there it is."
It was more than a man like Maud could hope to earn in a lifetime of abusing prisoners.
"And remember what I said. This is only a taste. If you ever grow tired of Lady Arryn's service, present yourself at Casterly Rock, and I'll pay you the rest of what I owe you."
With golden dragons spilling out of both hands, Maud had fallen to his knees and promised that he would do just that. Bronn yanked out his dirk and pulled the meat from the fire. He began to carve thick chunks of charred meat off the bone as Tyrion hollowed out two heels of stale bread to serve as trenchers.
"If we do reach the river, what will you do then?"
the sellsword asked as he cut.
"Oh, a hoa, and a feather bed, and a flagon of wine for a start."
Tyrion held out his trencher, and Bronn filled it with meat.
"And then to Casterly Rock or King's Landing, I think. I have some questions that want answering concerning a certain dagger."
The sellsword chewed and swallowed.
"So you are telling it true. It was not your knife."
Tyrion smiled thinly.
"Do I look a liar to you?"
By the time their bellies were full, the stars had come out, and a half-moon was rising over the mountains. Tyrion spread his shadow-skin cloak on the ground and stretched out with his saddle for a pillow.
"Our friends are taking their sweet time."
"If I were them, I'd fear a trap," Bronn said. "Why else would we be so open, if not to lure them in?"
Tyrion chuckled.
"Then we ought to sing and send them fleeing in terror."
He began to whistle a tune.
"You're mad, dwarf,"
Bronn said, as he cleared the grease from under his nails with his dirk.
"Where's your love of music, Bronn?"
"If it was music you wanted, you should have gotten a singer to champion you."
Tyrion grinned.
"That would have been amusing. I can just see him fending off Ser Vardis with his wood harp."
He resumed his whistling.
"Do you know this song?" he asked.
"You hear it here and there, in inns and whorehouses."
"Moorish, the seasons of my love, sweet and sad, if you understand the words. The first girl I ever bedded used to sing it, and I've never been able to put it out of my head."
Tyrion gazed up at the sky It was a clear, cold night, and the stars shone down upon the mountains as bright and merciless as truth.
"I met her on a night like this," he heard himself saying. "Jamie and I were riding back from Lannisport when we heard a scream, and she came running out into the road with two men dogging her heels, shouting threats. My brother unsheathed his sword and went after them, while I dismounted to protect the girl. She was scarcely a year older than I was, dark-haired, slender, with a face that would break your heart. It certainly broke mine. Low-born, half-starved, unwashed, yet lovely. They'd torn the rag she was wearing half off her back, so I wrapped her in my cloak while Jamie chased the men into the woods. By the time he came trotting back, I'd gotten a name out of her and a story. She was a crofter's child, orphaned, when her father died of fever on her way to, well, nowhere, really. Jamie was all in a lather to hunt down the men. It was not often outlaws dead prey on travellers so near to Castle Rock, and he took it as an insult. The girl was too frightened to send off by herself, though, so I offered to take her to the closest inn and feed her while my brother rode back to the rock for help. She was hungrier than I would have believed. We finished two whole chickens and part of a third and drank a flagon of wine, talking. I was only 13, and the wine went to my head, I fear. The next thing I knew, I was sharing her bed. If she was shy, I was shyer. I'll never know where I found the courage. When I broke her maidenhead, she wept. But afterward, she kissed me and sang her little song, and by morning, I was in love.
You?
Ron's voice was amused.
Absurd, isn't it?
Tyrion began to whistle the song again.
I married her,
he finally admitted.
A Lannister of Castle Rock, wed to a crofter's daughter, Bronn said. How could you manage that?
Oh, you'd be astonished at what a boy can make of a few lies, 50 pieces of silver, and a drunken septon. I dared not bring my bride home to Castle Rock, so I set her up in a cottage of her own, and for a fortnight we played at being man and wife. And then the septon sobered and confessed all to my lord father.
Tyrion was surprised how desolate it made him feel to say it, even after all these years. Perhaps he was just tired.
That was the end of my marriage.
He sat up and stared at the dying fire, blinking at the light.
He sent the girl away?
He did better than that, Tyrion said. First he made my brother tell me the truth. The girl was a whore, you see. Jamie arranged the whole affair, the road, the outlaws, all of it. He thought it was time I had a woman. He paid double for a maiden, knowing it would be my first time. After Jamie had made his confession, to drive home the lesson, Lord Tywin brought my wife in and gave her to his guards. They paid her fair enough, a silver for each man. How many whores command that higher price? He sat me down in the corner of the barracks and bade me watch. And at the end, she had so many silvers, the coins were slipping through her fingers and rolling on the floor.
The smoke was stinging his eyes. Tyrion cleared his throat and turned away from the fire to gaze into the darkness.
Lord Tywin had me go last, he said in a quiet voice, and he gave me a gold coin to pay her, because I was a Lannister, and worth more.
After a time, he heard the noise again, the rasp of steel on stone, as Brun sharpened his sword.
13, or 30, or 3. I would have killed a man who did that to me.
Tyrion swung around to face him.
You may get that chance one day. Remember what I told you. A Lannister always pays his debts.
He yawned.
I think I will try that sleep.
Wake me if we're about to die.
He rolled himself up in the shadow skin and shut his eyes. The ground was stony and cold, but after a time Tyrion Lannister did sleep. He dreamt of the Sky Cell. This time he was the jailer, not the prisoner. Big, with a strap in his hand, and he was hitting his father, driving him back towards the abyss.
Tyrion?
Bronn's warning was low and urgent. Tyrion was awake in the blink of an eye. The fire had burned down to embers, and the shadows were creeping in all round them. Bronn had raised himself to one knee, his sword in one hand and his dirk in the other. Tyrion held up a hand. Stay still, it said.
Come, shed our fire. The night is cold, he called out to the creeping shadows. I fear we've no wine to offer you, but you're welcome to some of our goat.
All movement stopped. Tyrion saw the glint of moonlight on metal.
Our mountain,
a voice called out from the trees, deep and hard and unfriendly.
Our goat.
Your goat, Tyrion agreed. Who are you? When you meet your guards, a different voice replied, say it was Gunther, son of Gurn of the Stone Crows, who sent you to them.
A branch cracked underfoot as he stepped into the light, a thin man with a horned helmet, armed with a long knife.
And Shagger, son of Dolph.
That was the first voice, deep and deadly. A boulder shifted to their left and stood and became a man.
Massive and slow and strong he seemed, dressed all in skins with a club in his right hand and an axe in his left. He smashed them together as he lumbered closer.
Other voices called other names. Conn and Torrick and Jagat and more that Tyrion forgot the instant he heard them. 10 at least. A few had swords and knives, others brandished pitchforks and scythes and wooden spears. He waited until they'd done shouting out their names before he gave them an answer.
I am Tyrion, son of Tywin, of the Clan Lannister, the Lions of the Rock. We will gladly pay you for the goat we ate.
What have you got to give us, Tyrion, son of Tywin?
Asked the one who named himself Gunther, who seemed to be their chief.
There is silver in my purse, Tyrion told them. This hauberk I wear is large for me, but it should fit Conn nicely, and the battle axe I carry would suit Shaggy's mighty hand far better than the wood axe he holds. The half-man would pay us with our own coin, said Conn.
Conn speaks truly, Gunther said. Your silver's ours. Your horses are ours. Your hauberk, and your battle axe, and the knife at your belt, these are ours too. You have nothing to give us but your lives. How would you like to die, Tyrion, son of Tywin?
In my own bed, with a belly full of wine and a maiden's mouth around my cock at the age of 80, he replied.
The huge one, Shagger, laughed first and loudest. The others seemed less amused.
Conn, take their horses, Gunther commanded. Kill the other, and seize the half-man. He can milk the goats, and make the mothers laugh.
Bronn sprang to his feet.
Who dies first?
No, Tyrion said sharply. Gunther, son of Gurn, hear me. My house is rich and powerful. If the Stone Crows will see us safely through these mountains, my lord father will shower you with gold.
The gold of a lowland lord is as worthless as a half-man's promises, Gunther said.
Half a man I may be, Tyrion said, yet I have the courage to face my enemies.
What do the Stone Crows do?
but hide behind rocks and shiver with fear as the knights of the Vale ride by. Shagga gave a roar of anger and clashed club against axe. Jagat poked at Tyrion's face with the far-hardened point of a long wooden spear. He did his best not to flinch.
"Are these the best weapons you could steal?" he said. "Good enough for killing sheep, perhaps, if the sheep do not fight back. My father's smiths shit better steal."
"Our little boy man," Shagga replied, "will you mock my axe after I chop off your manhood and feed it to the goats?"
But Gunther raised a hand.
"No, I would hear his words. The mothers go hungry, and steel fills more mouths than gold. What would you give us for your lives, Tyrion, son of Tywin? Swords? Lances? Mail?"
"All that, and more, Gunther, son of Gurn," Tyrion Lannister replied, smiling.
"I will give you the Vale of Arryn."
Eddard. Through the high, narrow windows of the Red Keep's cavernous throne room, the light of sunset spilled across the floor, laying dark red stripes upon the walls where the heads of dragons had once hung. Now the stern was covered with hunting tapestries, vivid with greens and browns and blues, and yet it still seemed to Ned Stark that the only color in the hall was the red of blood. He sat high upon the immensely ancient seat of Aegon the Conqueror, an ironwork monstrosity of spikes and jagged edges and grotesquely twisted metal. It was, as Robert had warned him, a hellishly uncomfortable chair, and never more so than now, with his shattered leg throbbing more sharply every minute. The metal beneath him had grown harder by the hour, and the fanged steel behind made it impossible to lean back. A king should never sit easy, Aegon the Conqueror had said, when he commanded his armourers to forge a great seat from swords laid down by his enemies. Damn Aegon for his arrogance, Ned thought solemnly, and damn Robert, and his hunting as well.
"You are quite certain these were more than brigands?" Varys asked softly from the council table beneath the throne. Grand Maester Pycelle stirred uneasily beside him, while Littlefinger toyed with a pen. They were the only councillors in attendance. A white hart had been sighted in the Kingswood, and Lord Renly and Sir Barristan had joined the king to hunt it, along with Prince Joffrey, Sandor Clegane, Balin Swan, and half the court. So Ned must needs sit the Iron Throne in his absence. At least he could sit. Save the council, the rest must stand respectfully or kneel. The petitioners clustered near the tall doors, the knights and high lords and ladies beneath the tapestries, the small folk in the gallery, the male guards in their cloaks, gold or grey, all stood. The villagers were kneeling, men, women and children, alike tattered and bloody, their faces drawn by fear. The three knights who had brought them here to bear witness stood behind them. "Brigands, Lord Varys?" Sir Raymond Darry's voice dripped scorn. "Oh, they were brigands beyond a doubt. Lannister brigands." Ned could feel the unease in the hall, as high lords and servants alike strained to listen. He could not pretend to surprise. The West had been a tinderbox since Catelyn had seized Tyrion Lannister. Both River Run and Castle Rock had called their banners, and armies were massing in the pass below the Golden Tooth. It had only been a matter of time until the blood began to flow. The sole question that remained was how best to staunch the wound. Sad-eyed, Sir Carol Vance, who would have been handsome but for the wine-stained birthmark that discolored his face, gestured at the kneeling villagers. "This is all that remains of the whole House of Shearer, Lord Eddard. The rest are dead, along with the people of Wendish Town and the Mummer's Ford." "Rise," Ned commanded the villagers. He never trusted what a man told him from his knees.
All of you, up. In ones and twos, the whole fast of Shearer struggled to its feet. One ancient needed to be helped, and a young girl in a bloody dress stayed on her knees, staring blankly at Sir Aerys Oakheart, who stood by the foot of the throne in the white armour of the King's Guard, ready to protect and defend the king. Or Ned supposed the king's hand. "Joss," Sir Raymond Darry said to a plump, balding man in a brewer's apron, "tell the hand what happened at Shearer." Joss nodded.
"If it please His Grace."
"His Grace is hunting across the Blackwater," Ned said, wondering how a man could live his whole life a few days' ride from the Red Keep and still have no notion what his king looked like. Ned was clad in a white linen doublet with a direwolf of Stark on the breast. His black wool cloak was fastened at the collar by the silver hand of office. Black and white and grey, all the shades of truth. "I am Lord Eddard Stark, the king's hand. Tell me who you are and what you know of these raiders."
I capped an alehouse, my lord, in Shearer, by the stone bridge. The finest ale south of the neck. Everyone said so, begging your pardons, my lord. It's gone now, like all the rest, my lord. They come and drank their fill and spilled the rest before they fired my roof. And they would have spilled my blood, too, if they caught me, my lord.
They burnt us out, a farmer beside him said. Come riding in the dark, up from the south, and fired the fields and the houses alike. Killing them is trying to stop them. There weren't no raiders, though, my lord. They had no mind to steal our stock, not these. They butchered my milk cow where she stood, and left her for the flies and the crows.
They rode down my prentice boy, said a squat man, with a smith's muscles and a bandage around his head.
He had put on his finest clothes to come to court, but his breeches were patched, his cloak travel-stained and dusty.
Chased him back and forth across the fields on their horses, poking at him with their lances like it was a game, them laughing and the boys tumbling and screaming till the big one pierced him clean through.
The girl on her knees craned her head up at Ned, high above her, on the throne.
They killed my mother too, Your Grace, and they...
Her voice trailed off, as if she had forgotten what she was about to say. She began to sob. Sir Raymond Darry took up the tale.
At Wendishtown, the people sought shelter in their holdfast, but the walls were timbered. The raiders piled straw against the wood and burnt them all alive. When the Wendish folk opened their gates to flee the fire, they shot them down with arrows as they came running out, even women with suckling babes.
"Oh, dreadful," murmured Varys. "How cruel can men be?"
"They would have done the same for us, but the Shearer holdfast made of stone," Joss said. "Some wanted to smoke us out, but the big one said there was riper fruit upriver, and they made for the Mummer's Ford."
Ned could feel cold steel against his fingers as he leaned forward. Between each finger was a blade, the points of twisted swords, fanning out like talons from the arms of the throne. Even after 3 centuries, some were still sharp enough to cut. The Iron Throne was full of traps for the unwary. The song said it had taken 1,000 blades to make it, heated white-hot, in the furnace breath of Balerion the Black Dread. The hammering had taken 59 days. The end of it was this hunchback beast, made of razor edges and barbs and ribbons of sharp metal. A chair that could kill a man, and had, if the stories could be believed. What Eddard Stark was doing sitting there, he would never comprehend. Yet there he sat. And these people looked to him for justice. "What proof do you have that these were Lannisters?" he asked, trying to keep his fury under control. "Did they wear crimson cloaks or fly a lion banner?"
"Even Lannisters are not so blind stupid as that," Sir Mark Piper snapped. He was a swaggering bantam rooster of a youth, too young and too hot-blooded for Ned's taste.
though a fast friend of Catelyn's brother, Edmure Tully. Every man among them was mounted and mailed, my lord, Sir Carol answered calmly.